CheersCast is part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Her walking around in that wedding dress was just a tad too Miss Havisham for me.
Who?
Miss Havisham, famous character from Charles Dickens' Great Expectations, spends the entire novel walking around in her wedding dress.
What?
Yes. Well, surely you know it. It's Great Expectations. Pip, Miss Havisham, Magwitch, and four pizza-loving turtles who practice martial arts in the sewer.
A lot of people don't realize that that was a comic book first.
You wanna go where everybody knows your name.
Hello and welcome back to CheersCast, the podcast where everybody knows your name. I'm your host, Ryan Daly, and I am thrilled to welcome a brand new guest to the show, making his debut like 7 years later than he should have. Please welcome Dan Liebke. How are you, Dan?
I'm really good, Ryan. How are you?
I'm really good. We were just kind of talking about this beforehand. Folks, peeking behind the curtain, Dan is graciously ignoring the fact that I ghosted him for way too long on accident because he asked me to be on the show back during like season four. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. I'll get you on a show. And then promptly forgot that conversation ever took place, regardless of the email trail that it led to. But yeah, finally got you back, just in time for an episode that you say is your favorite. So, that'll be exciting. Yep. But before we get there, Dan, I have to ask, when, how, why did you become a Cheers fan?
Right. So as you probably could tell from my accent, I am from Australia, and I specifically grew up in a small country town in Australia. Where I grew up, we only had two TV stations as I was growing up for the most part. So we had, the ABC, which is kind of the equivalent of the BBC in the UK, so that's a public broadcaster. And then there was one other commercial station, which in addition, like it had a few Australian-produced shows, but mostly it was just US shows. Basically, the pick of the crop of US shows would show up on that. So that's what we'd get, and they'd somehow fit them all into the schedule. So I was about 12 or 13 when Cheers first started airing on this channel. And I remember just seeing the odd episode here or there, and it just intrigued me. It was just like I was just old enough to go, this seems cleverer than most things I've seen. And yeah. I remember my mum used to stay up and watch it, and I'd stay up and watch it with her. And it was very intriguing to me. And I specifically remember there's one episode that has always stuck with me, and I had to look it up. It was quite hard to look up, but it's from season four. It's Don Juan is Hell. Mm-hmm. And that episode, if you remember, it ends with Sam and Diane in the office. They're trying to convince one another they can have this kind of platonic relationship. And everything they say just kind of leads to more and more innuendo and them getting hot with one another. And right at the very end, Diane gets all worked up. She goes to leave and she pulls the doorknob off the door. And then without breaking, she just hands it to Sam and says, "Your doorknob." And he says, "Thank you." And then you go, bam, closing credits. And I just remember watching that and going, wait, you can end an episode like that? Is that possible to end a sitcom episode like that? And for some reason, that's just stuck in my brain as kind of epitome of how smart and different and great it was. So I love that. And by the time we're into this ninth season, which we're about to talk about, I've moved out of home. I'm living in a one-bedroom apartment in Sydney, and I've got a VCR, and I'm just taping every episode as they come on. Because this was how you streamed things back in the day, kids. You'd tape it, and if you wanted to watch it again, you just rewind the tape and watch it. But if you didn't do that, they were gone. So, so that's what I did. And this was one of the ones that I definitely did not tape over. There are a whole heap in a row here that I didn't tape over, like as banger episode after banger episode. Oh, yeah. So, I rewatched this episode loads of times on that videotape in the early 1990s. And when I went back to watch it for this podcast, it just felt so incredibly familiar. It's just kind of entrenched in my brain, this episode.
We would tape the occasional episode, usually because it was family viewing for us.
Yep.
But if my mom or my dad weren't there, if they had something going on, or if there was, for whatever reason, if they couldn't watch it, we would tape it for them. So I had obviously the 200th episode, but I had a couple of episodes from season 9 and 10 that I distinctly remember. One, the Rat Girl episode from later on this season, and the Halloween one from next season with Gary's, and those were the ones I distinctly remember watching over and over and over again. But
yeah.
But yeah, folks, getting into this one, we are at season 9, episode 17. I'm getting my act together and sticking it in your face. I sort of play on the phrase, I'm getting my act together and taking it on the road, kind of popular showbiz expression at the time. This one written by Dan Staley and Rob Long. It was directed by Andy Ackerman. The original air date was Thursday, February 7th, 1991. It's been days since Robin Colcord left Rebecca on their wedding day, and she hasn't left the office or changed out of her wedding gown. She finally emerges, ready and willing to spend her life sitting at the bar, wasting away like Norm and the others. Instead, she decides to leave Boston and return to San Diego. A week later, Sam calls Rebecca to tell her how much everyone at Cheers misses her, but slips and says he loves her. Later, she leaves a message that she's coming back to Cheers, having realized what she wants most in life. Afraid that Rebecca wants to marry him, Sam enlists a friend to tell Rebecca that he is Sam's lover. Of course, Rebecca didn't want to marry Sam. She wanted to buy the bar from him. And she knows he only concocted this ruse about being gay because he was afraid to talk to her honestly. Rather than look like a coward, Sam kisses his friend on the lips, for which he receives a punch in the face. Meanwhile, Frasier tries to ignite the gang's passion for literature by reading the works of Charles Dickens. When the guys start to get bored, however, Frasier resorts to injecting the great works with pop culture references to Stephen King, Star Trek, and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, among others. There's a lot going on in this episode. I always remember the B plot more for this episode, the Frasier reading Charles Dickens and everything. Like, that is such an amazing plot. And then I'm always reminded, I was like, oh yeah, this is the one where Sam pretends that he has a lover in order to get away from Rebecca. I was like, how is this one going to age?
I was worried about the exact same thing. And I mean, we'll get to it. I definitely have some thoughts on that, but yeah, But before we went back to watch it, because I hadn't watched it in, I don't know how long, 15, 20 years maybe. Yeah. I was just thinking, not sure how that's going to age. But yeah, we'll see when we get there, I guess.
Yeah, I'll spoil a little bit of my take on it, which is, like a lot of the things having to do with Sam's character when viewed in a sort of contemporary lens, it's not great, but it's not as bad as it could have been.
Yeah.
In comparison.
Yeah, that's pretty much my feeling as well.
As far as cringe factors, it's like, all right, don't love that, but
yeah,
it didn't ruin it for me, so we'll get to that much.
Yeah.
When we get into our teaser, it's a short little one, but I've always enjoyed this one. The guys are doing little hand gesture things. It's like that. I don't even know how to describe it, but Cliff is doing one that I've always loved where you put your fingers together in your hands and then you invert your middle fingers and twist your hands and you can kind of make like your middle finger shaking. And then they're doing other tricks. Woody has the whole thing, like the pretending like he's separating his index finger from it. He's like, he learned this from his uncle. Of course, when Woody does it,
when I do it, it's a trick.
It's a trick.
Yeah,
and Frasier and Lilith walk in upon this, and they're like, "Okay, what are you guys up to now? What is this whole thing?" And Cliff refers to it as the Tricks with Digits and the annual Tricks with Digits competition.
Yes, the first annual. So you know, it's about to become a thing.
And Frasier and Lilith are like, "Well, this is the biggest waste of time." They're like, "What? Why? Just because it's stupid?" It's like, "No, because nobody can top Lilith." And bless her, B.B. Newworth puts her whole fist into her mouth, and the mouth with the like opening the capacity for that, and you know that she's a singer and she's a performer, so that just it sells it. But also, just it's such a ridiculous thing for Lilith of all people to be able to do, and they're blown away. They're like, "Wow, that is impressive!" And they're like, "The king is dead. Long live the queen." And then she just starts to scribble something on a note on the sign. Like, oh, she's writing too. Going for bonus points. and what did she write? And Frasier picks up the note and just kind of like reads it. My fist is stuck. Call 911.
Yes. And then I love Frasier's like aside to the guys as he's leaving. Like, this happens to her more often than you think.
More often than you think. Yeah. And it's metaphorically, you can see Frasier and Lilith getting to a point where they would put their foot in their mouth or their fist in their mouth. But to actually see that physically, actually, it's like, this happens more often than you think. It's like, what are you doing? What kind of parties are you throwing?
Yeah.
Lilith has been great since the beginning, but we're now in the era. And like, this is where like B.B. Newworth is firmly nominated every season for a supporting actress award. And she's winning these awards now. And like, this is an era where I think like, almost like in seasons 1 and 2, if I couldn't decide on who my MVP of the episode was, I could always fall back on Coach. It's like, if it's a toss up, like whatever Coach is doing, he's worthy of being the MVP, even if he's not the star of the show. Like, I feel like now we're in a thing where whenever Lilith is on the show, she could be the best part about the episode.
Yeah. Yeah, she's so good, isn't she? She's like, B.B. Newworth is, she's fantastic. I love everything she does. That's such a strong character.
So good. So good. When we come back from the opening credits, for one little note, the jukebox is back. The jukebox that was gone for the previous two episodes with the karaoke machine. And we're in this situation now where Carla and Woody are unable to make any sort of cocktails because they don't have access to any of the mixers. All of the ingredients that they need are in the back storeroom, which is in the office, and the door is locked. They can't get to it. So Woody's like, Sam just said substitute something. So Carla takes a martini glass, shoves it in something, and hands it to Paul, our new tertiary barfly. And he's like, what is this? And she's like, clam juice.
Clam juice, yeah.
And he's like, what is this? He wanted a martini. And she's like, well, I wanted to be Princess Carla of Monaco.
Yeah. But Paul seems very cool about the clam juice. He's just like, oh, well, I'll give this a try. Why not?
Yeah. He's like, well, you know, it could have been worse. And they explain that they can't get in the storeroom because Rebecca has locked herself in there. It's like Robin left her, you know, she confessed that she only loved him for his money. And now that he's poor, she doesn't want to marry him. So then he revealed he did have this money and he left with $6 million. And she's so depressed. She hasn't come out of the office. She hasn't eaten or bathed or gone to the bathroom. She's just sitting there in her wedding dress. It's really depressing. That's awful. I really wanted a martini.
Yes. Yeah. Has his priorities right, does Paul.
And then Fraser comes in. In a perfect Fraser fashion, he says he is of a Dickensian spirit.
Yes. Yes, he enters, a pint of lager, my good publican. I'm of a Dickensian spirit this evening. So that's just great.
Yeah. And he says that he was at this antique book fair thing and he bought an original copy of Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities. He mentions it's his favorite book. And Woody's like, wow, that's incredible. He's like, can I ask how much that cost? And like Woody's like taking the book and kind of just flipping through it. And Fraser's obviously like, he's like, money isn't money is not important. Although he's clearly upset about how he's like, this is valuable. Don't. And he tells Woody, he's like, yeah, it cost him about $1,200.
And Woody's like, and Woody's just stunned, right? He's like, $1,200
for a book. And he's like, Fraser, he's like, Dr. Crane, let me show you something that this might be of interest to you. And he opens his wallet. He takes out a library card.
So, yeah.
Which is a good gag. And I never thought about that, but upon a rewatch, it's funny because that sets up Woody is going to his wallet because the fate of Woody's wallet will become a joke later on in the episode.
That's true. Yes.
I just kind of like that. I was like, oh yeah, we're seeing Woody interact with his wallet and that will be a punchline later on. So that's funny.
Yep. I didn't realize that at the time, but yes, that's a good point.
Yeah. Carla comes up to Fraser. She's like, Fraser, you need to do something. You need to get Rebecca out of that office. We can't work like this. We can't live like this with her in there. And Fraser's like, look, I know you come to me and you expect me to solve all your problems, but he's like, but I don't think I can do anything here. She's beyond my capacity. And Carla's like, I know, but I also know how much you whine when we don't ask you. Fraser just gets a pitiful, childish look on his face. Like,
fine.
But maybe I'll go home.
Yes, very pitiful.
Then a great moment, Sam comes in with a toolbox and he's talking to Rebecca through the door. And it's almost like a phone call conversation where we don't hear her responding, but he's narrating everything for her and for the audience. Like, I got a screwdriver and I'm going to take the doorknob off the handle. It kind of like digs in. Hey, Rebecca, I got a Phillips head here and I needed to get a flathead. So hang on. And he digs around. He's like, Rebecca, I don't have a flathead screwdriver, but I'm going to use this putty knife thing.
I've heard it called a putty thing. I've just one of those putty things.
Putty things. And then he kind of winces in pain, like kind of holds it. He's like, Rebecca, I punctured my thumb on the putty thing. It's like, I'm going to get a tetanus shot and come back with a Phillips head screwdriver. And then as he's about to leave, the door opens and just unceremoniously, she just walks up with like a first aid kit. She's like, here, have a Band-Aid. And everyone's like, hey, it's Rebecca. And the hair is disheveled. It's all in a mess. In the bridal dress, Bride of Frankenstein, kind of very vibe to it and everything. They're like, look, it's Rebecca is out. And she's like, no. Rebecca doesn't live here anymore.
Rebecca died 2 days ago.
And Carla Pence is like, well, that's what that smell is.
Yes. Yeah.
Norm offers her a seat, his seat at the corner of the bar.
That's the key.
Yeah, that's the key. Because she's sitting on the stool and she's like, you know, she didn't need to come out because she has no future. Her life is a mess. She's a totally helpless failure. And Norm just with a smile on his face, like, yeah. She's one of us now. He's like, try it with beer nuts. And he passes her a bowl of the beer nuts. He's like, you got the right spirit, the right attitude to sit in that seat. And she's like, you know, this is, what could I expect? This is my fault. She's like, she just got what she deserved for being a worthless, shallow person. And Norm's like, I'm telling you, try it with the beer nuts.
With the beer nuts. Yeah.
And Fraser kind of comes up to her. Is like, you need to get some perspective, get out of this bar, kind of reexamine your life. And she would, but she's lost the will to move. She just wants to sit on that stool for the rest of her life.
I love Norm's quote. Geez, maybe it's the stool.
Maybe it's the stool.
which is so good.
Particularly because of this podcast, I have mentioned it many times, describing Cheers as a gravity well. Everything comes back and is pulled down to Norm's level. And the fact that there's even, like, as Carla pointed out, there's indentation, like the floor is shallower on that seat. But like, just this idea that there might be something sort of metaphysical, cosmic about that stool that just saps people's energy.
From some kind of black hole within it or something.
Yeah. And he's like, wow, she's just talking like so depressed when she sits in that seat. He's like, maybe it's the stool. Maybe if I sat for her. And Woody takes her back to the bathrooms to kind of splash some water on her face and get herself cleaned up. And she's like, Woody, have you ever had your whole life suddenly cave in on you or cave in on you all of a sudden? And he's like, no, man, but I have had a cave in on me all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Another great, like, oh, Woody. I can't decide if we missed out on a great Woody spinoff, like in Hanover, like discovering all these characters, or if it's one of those things where the imagination will always be better than what they could actually
put. I think it's got to be the imagination. I'm not sure you could actually create a real sitcom or show that lived up to whatever madness Woody's concocting all the time.
Because I don't think I ever even picked up on it until redoing this podcast that I think almost every time he refers to Hanover in some insane situation or circumstance, I think he always references a different family member or a different friend. I don't think
much always being dismembered or something.
Always dismembered. Yeah. There's so much maiming going on in Hanover with his family. But like, yeah.
So if nothing else, this theoretical sitcom, you know, would be a challenge for casting or special effects, one or the other.
Every week, a new guest star like Columbo or something gets their hand caught in a trap or something.
Yeah.
This is when Fraser kind of mentions offhand, it's, you know, her walking around this wedding dress. It's a tad bit too Miss Havisham for me.
Yes.
And they're like, what are you talking about? And he's like, you know, the character from Great Expectations. She walks around in her wedding dress and guys don't know this reference. And he's like, Great Expectations, Pip, Magwitch, Miss Havisham. And they have a backstory and they couldn't care less. And poor pizza loving turtles who practice martial arts in the sewer.
That gets a very interesting indeed.
Yeah, like Norm actually does the cowabunga thing. And I love Cliff pointing out, he's like, you know, a lot of people don't know that was actually a comic book first. I was like,
yes.
That's actually one of the things that Cliff says that's true.
And this is really timely, right? Because the first Turtles movie came out the year before, I think. So this is all very up-to-date pop culture that Fraser's referencing here.
Right, right. I love that, yeah. But like when Cliff mentioned, yeah, that was a comic book first. I'm like, Cliff, that's actually accurate.
It's a fact, right. Yeah.
One of the few times when you hit the target. And then Rebecca comes out of the bag wearing clothes. And if you were of a keen eye, you would recognize that was the outfit that Woody was wearing a minute ago. And she says she's going to go for a drive. And they're like, oh, that's a good idea. You know, get some fresh air, get some perspective. And she walks off and they're like, wait, where did she get that out? Where did she get those clothes? Woody comes out wearing just the wedding dress wrapped like a towel around his waist. And he's like, Sam, can you get me some clothes out of the lost and found? And then we get to just a few minutes later, whatever it is, Woody comes out wearing a new outfit. He's got a blue leisure suit. It's just like a wide lapel, red shirt underneath it. Very white socks, which we can see because the slacks do not go down very low.
Yes. Although I kind of find it amusing this far out. I mean, Woody's 70s outfit looks ridiculous, but a lot of the 80s and 90s fashion looks pretty ridiculous to modernize too. So it's kind of funny how this is, you know, within continuity, seen as absolutely absurd. It's just like, well, you're all dressed pretty absurdly to more modernize.
Yeah. And actually, like, the cyclical nature of like
yes.
Within a few years, like that kind of like 70s fashion would come back a little bit, and he could get away with wearing that outfit. Like, if the pants were taken in a little bit, you know. Just,
yeah.
But they're all kind of laughing at the outfit and everything. And Woody says, I know it was the 70s, but who would wear something this dumb looking? And Cliff comes out of the pool room. He's like, hey, those duds look familiar.
Yeah. Yes.
Carla checks the name tag. She's like, it says property of C. Clavin. And she turns around to the guy. She's like, didn't we know that in our hearts?
Yeah.
And actually, I think Kelsey Grammer gave the biggest laugh from that line. Like, I think maybe like more than the character Frasier. I think Kelsey Grammer liked that one.
And then, of course, the mystery is, well, how did they get in the lost property in the first place?
Yeah. And Cliff's like, oh, it was the 70s and I was a swinger.
And he just all these horrific images.
Yeah. They're like, oh, we don't want to know. He's like, you know, it was the disco scene and I got rolfed or something like that. And
Cliff, what he's like, in hot tubs every night.
Yeah, he's like, please, Mr. Clavin, don't say anything. Don't say anymore. He's like, oh, I remember. I was streaking. They're like, oh, take that image out of our heads.
And then he adds, of course, I was 3 pounds lighter then.
It's like three pounds. Yeah.
Yeah.
Frasier mentions that he is impressed by Woody's sacrifice of his clothes, and it reminds him of another sacrifice by a character in his favorite novel. And he refers to, he's like, you know who I'm talking about? Charles.
And then Norm's like, in charge?
Yeah. It's like, no, Charles Dickens. And the ham-handedness of this segue, he's like, Woody, sacrificing his clothes reminds me of the sacrifice Sidney Carton makes in Tale of Two Cities. He's like, he goes to a guillotine. Like, these sacrifices are not comparable, Frasier. You just really wanted to read the book.
Frasier's desperate to talk about Dickens again. That's all he wants to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, because he says, are you people really this ignorant, or do you just do this to torture me? And they're like, yeah, sometimes both. Frasier says he will right a terrible wrong by reading them A Tale of Two Cities. And so they sit around, they're like, okay, let's indulge this. He reads the first of the opening passage, the very famous line. He says, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And Norm just stops. Whoa. Which was it?
And then Frasier's like, just stay tuned, Norm. And I'll stop. This is my home run. I love that. That's so good.
It was the age of enlightenment. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epic of belief, epic of incredulity. And he's going through this whole contrasting thing from the opening paragraph. And Cliff is just like, this Dickens guy really liked to cover his butt.
Yeah.
And they just turned their back to Frasier. They couldn't care less. And he's like, there was a king with a strong jaw on the throne of England, and there was a bloodthirsty clown which beckoned innocent children into the sewers and swallowed them whole. And they're like, what?
Yeah. And I love the intonation of Frasier as he says the swallow them whole. It's like just pure Kelsey Grammer, like this resonant, powerful voice, and swallowed them whole.
Right.
And so it's so good. Yeah.
Which again,
like the It miniseries was like only a couple of months earlier. This is so timely.
Exactly. Yeah, the book had come out in the earlier 80s or mid 80s. But yeah, the miniseries with Tim Curry as Pennywise and actually starring Harry Anderson was in that miniseries, who played Harry the Hat in the show.
That's true. Yes. Good link.
And but I remember I watched that miniseries when it was it wouldn't have been my first exposure to Stephen King, and as much as I knew who he was, and I knew I hadn't read any of him at that time, but I knew the movies based on his work. So I knew him as a name. So I remember when that came out, like kind of the whole idea of it being this miniseries. And I was just of an age where I could stay up. And I loved that miniseries. Like I thought it was like really creepy. Well done. That was the first Stephen King book I ended up reading when I was in high school.
I was a Stephen King reader, and I remember I got it for Christmas. And basically I spent Christmas Day and Boxing Day the next day, just read it nonstop in 2 days, like whatever it is, 1,000 pages. I just burned through it. It was such a compelling and captivating book.
What's your favorite Stephen King, I gotta ask?
That'd be close. I also love The Stand. The Stand is great.
I think my favorite is Salem's Lot. It does a lot of what it does in terms of establishing the whole world, the whole town, but it's not as sprawling and as ambitious as it. It's a little bit more confined. I think Salem's Lot was the first book I read that actually had a, and I read it when I was in college, so I was older.
Yeah.
But it was still like the first book where I read it and I was like, this part is creepy. I never had that sensation of reading something where I was like, I don't want to be in the dark right now. Like I need to.
Yeah. I don't really get scared by books as well. So Stephen King, I never really thought he was, obviously he's writing horror, but they didn't scare me as such. I didn't get creeped out, but I just loved loved his style. I just loved reading his books.
Yeah, I do. And I would go through phases. And unfortunately, one of my Stephen King phases coincided when my wife was pregnant. So I read Pet Sematary just before my son was born and Cujo right after it. And that back-to-back messed me up.
I can imagine, yes. That's not a good choice.
Yeah, I love Pet Sematary. Cujo just felt mean-spirited by the time I got to the end of it. Anyway, we're getting sidetracked on Stephen King. Fun. I could talk about that, but anyway, they're totally invested in this whole thing. He's talking about the clown from It, like inserting this into the idea of like it's part of a Tale of Two Cities. Now the guy's like, tell us more, more. So he's already brought up the idea of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Now he's bringing up Stephen King. It's like, where is this going to go? Rebecca then calls the bar. She's on an airplane, so we get a little they built a little partial set of the airplane, calling from the pay phone where you have to like hook it up and pay with the credit card.
I also love how Sam answers the phone because he's so into this Dickens story. He's just like, what? He's really irritated. He has to answer the phone.
that was true. He's like, yeah, what? Cheers, what? It's like, Sam, why would you answer the phone that way? But he's really invested in the story. He wants to hear more.
Yeah.
But she says, I'm on an airplane. I'm heading back to San Diego. She goes, tell Woody I left his car in front of the United terminal. Or maybe he was American. I don't know. They all tow him to the same spot anyway, the same place. Yes. And Woody's like, is that Mr. Howell? She's like, tell her I need my car keys back. And Sam's like, actually, that's not going to be a problem. Woody, he's like, don't worry about that. And she's like, well, does she have my wallet? I need my bike. She's like, all right, does she have my wallet still? And Sam's like, do you have his wallet? And she's like, yeah, of course. How do you think I'm paying for this phone call? Heck, how do you think I'm paying for this flight?
And Sam's just like deadpan. Yeah, he's got it. Yeah, she's got it.
she got it to her. And then Woody's just like, yes, good to know. He didn't lose it. There's an amazing callback that I like in this book because she says she's going to San Diego. She wants to get away from Boston and Cheers and forget everything about her life over the past 3 years. And Sam corrects her. It's like, it's been 5, Rebecca. And she does it's the same line, the same type of delivery that she did at the beginning of season 8 when he was trying to get her to go on a date with him because he's talking about your love life. You haven't had a boyfriend in the 3 years that you've been here. And she's like, has it been that long? And she breaks down to crying. So now he's like, it's been 5 years. And he goes, has it been that long? And she's almost goes down. I'm like, nice.
She can do amazing things with her voice. Like, it's just uncanny.
Yeah. So she hangs up and she's going back to her seat. And the steward is like, Miss, how? Or she's like, Miss, you forgot your credit card. She's like, oh, yeah, I need to buy a whole new wardrobe when I get there. I'm going to be good to myself. It's like, buying all of this on Woody. First of all, I don't think Woody has a lot of credit.
No, Woody doesn't have the money.
I don't think you can buy a new wardrobe in San Diego, California. Then we cut to days later. Now, Frasier is at the end of A Tale of Two Cities. He's like, Sidney Carton was going to the guillotine when suddenly an Apache attack chopper hovered over the guillotine. He's like pumping hot lead into the crowd. And of course, Cliff takes a shot at the French. He's like, get them frogs.
Yeah. Yeah, the gang's really into this story now. They're loving it.
And Frasier paraphrases the final Sidney's last line where he says, "It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done." And instead of saying, "It is a far, far better rest that I go to," he goes, "It is a far, far better butt kicking I give than I have ever butt kicked." Like,
yes.
You choosing that verb phrase. I was like, what? And you just see Norm is just like, yeah. He's like, really? Like,
yeah. They love it so much. It's that's so good. And then they start asking, you know, what he's going to read to them next.
What is he going to read to them next? So he mentions maybe David Copperfield. I'm amazed that they didn't make this reference, and maybe the timing didn't line up, but there was a very famous stage magician, like yes. Popular on television. He had, like, specials broadcast everywhere. Stage magician named David Copperfield. He's still around, but he was very popular at this time.
Yeah.
Because I remember when I heard that.
Yeah, you would have thought it'd be a reference.
Yeah. But they're like, what's David Copperfield about? But instead, Frasier said it's about these two cops who were found in this field and they've been dismembered and their parts are all like rearranged. And now, according to IMDb, I had no idea about this, but I according to IMDb's trivia, this is probably a reference to the movie The Onion Field, which was Ted Danson's first movie. Where he played one of the cops in this, who's murdered in this field, and they find him. So when I saw it, I was like, that is an interesting catch. So,
that's a great catch. And I love Carla's response. That Dickens is one sick dude.
Yeah. <She's> like,
poor Charles Dickens.
And you got to imagine some point, like, if they were ever to bring this into conversation with somebody outside the bar and what somebody listening to them must think, like, wait, what?
Sam does bring it up later when he's leaving the message. He does mention the two coppers.
Right. Because this is where Sam comes out and he's like, we got to call Rebecca because it's been, you know, however many days or week or something. So he's leaving. He's like, he's calling her parents because she's staying at her parents. And he's like, oh, I just got the machine. And that's key that he's just talking to the answering machine. So he's like, hey, you know, we just want to let Rebecca know that we hope that she's okay. And, you know, we all miss her and I love you, or we miss you and I love you. And that's when Norma's like, whoa, 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 whoa. And Sam is like, hang on a second. And he kind of puts him out. It's the answering machine.
Yes.
And he puts his hand up. Yeah. He's like, what? He's like, you love her? He's like, no, I said we miss her and we love her. He's like, you said we miss her and you love her. And he's like, you love her. But Cliff is like, but it was implied that you miss her too.
You missed her too. Yeah.
And Sam's like, sweetheart, when I said I love you, you know, I wasn't talking about love. I just meant, you know, I love you like a friend or a partner, like the cops and David Copperfield.
I love the thought of Rebecca trying to pass what that means.
Yeah. And even Frasier's kind of like, oh boy. So and then they're like, you know, yeah, so Sam is going to hang up or something. All right, so goodbye. And then we're like, whoa, 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 Sam, that's a little bit cold. You got to be a little bit more famous. So, and Sam then goes, hey, so again, this is all to an answering machine message. You got to imagine like listening to this because he's taking breaks, like, hang on a second to have another conversation. Like, sweetie, when I say I love you, I mean, like, you're there's a lot of different kinds of love. You're a very important piece of my life, like a puzzle piece. And he's like, you're like a corner piece, how important that is. That's what you are. And then Norma's like, wait, we want to say something. He's like, okay, hang on. The guys want to say something to you. And it's great because before he does that, you can kind of see Cliff and Frasier and Norm all sort of like whispering something to each other. Like they're planning this.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right, guys, what do you want to say to Rebecca? And they all shout, Sammy loves you. And hangs up the phone so angry.
That's a great scene as well. I do enjoy that scene.
Yeah. Now, sometime later, days later, Frasier is there with Lilith and they want to know what book Frasier's going to read to them next. And Lilith is, she's impressed that she's cultural enrichment has worked, you know? Yeah. And Norm is like, yeah, we're waiting for Oliver Twist, The Wrath of Fagin. And Lilith's like,
this gets Lilith's kind of attention. Just like, wait, what's going on here?
Excuse me? And this probably my home run, because this is a line that I've always kept with me and used it more than a few times. Frasier won't even make eye contact with her, but she's just staring at him. And he's like, darling, I've done some things in the past few weeks that I'm not proud of.
Yeah.
That's the contrition, that's the explanation.
Yeah.
She's like, what have you done? But Rebecca or Sam comes out kind of in a panic because Rebecca left him a message that says, you know, something. She's coming back to Cheers. Hearing her voice reminded her of what she's missing. And her plane is going to arrive at midnight and she's going to go right to Cheers to see him. And he's freaking out. He's like, do you think she's coming here because I said I love you? And Norm's like,
yep.
Yeah. And he's like, come on, Norm, be serious. Can we once have a serious conversation? And do you think she thinks that I love her and that's what she's coming back to talk to me about? And Norm's like, yep. And he's like, Lilith, he's like, let me talk to somebody else who actually knows a thing or two about this. He's like, Lilith, what do you think? And she says, you're dead meat on a stick. You know, he's got ways of, she's not the first person who has tried to be Mrs. Sam Malone. He's got ways of getting women, you know, breaking it off with them. So that is not a problem. He's like, even if they don't all work, I can always rely on plan Z. And they're like, what's plan Z? He's like, never you mind. Just know it's pretty drastic, but I'll do it if I have to. And then he just kind of like bristling at the thought of it. He's like, I don't want to spend the rest of my life with the same woman hanging on me. Can you imagine how creepy that is, Frasier?
And then Lilith just turns and stares at Frasier and he's such a perfect look. Just cold.
Won't look in her direction, won't make eye contact. He's just like, I'll answer that another time, Sam. And he starts to like look over on the opposite side like he's fetching something. Something caught his attention.
And she's still staring at him.
So later still, we get another little time jump. Sam is talking to a guy named Leon. And just to kind of go through the guest stars in this episode, Lilith, obviously, played by B.B. Newirth. Paul Crapins, played by Paul Wilson. They're pretty much regulars. This guy, Leon, is played by Jeff McCarthy. He's appeared in a lot of action movies like RoboCop 2, Cliffhanger. Yeah. He was in the Joker movie not too long ago. Lots of TV, Star Trek shows. He's got voice work for games. Curiously, like he's in a lot of stuff, but his IMDb doesn't have like a normal profile picture. I was like, he's been working for 50 years. And like,
yeah,
he's a good looking guy, but I don't know that he's ever had like a lead or really like strong part or anything like that. And then the stewardess that we saw briefly is played by Jan Gann Boyd, only has 9 IMDb credits, some TV movies and like one-off appearances on shows. Anyway. So Sam is talking to this guy, Leon, and he says, you know, when he flashes the lights of the bar of Cheers, you come running in. Leon's like, I got it. He goes out there. And then at the other side of the bar, Norm and Cliff are like, Carla, we need to talk. She's like, what is it? She's like, what is this plan Z that Sammy keeps talking about? Carla's like, I'll tell you everything I know, but it'll cost you $20 each. Like, all right, let's do it. She goes, it's called plan Z. When Sam flashes the lights, that guy rushes in. Okay, we just saw that. We knew that much. And he's like, but what is plan Z? She's like, I don't know. That's all I know. I didn't know that much 2 minutes ago.
And I love the guys. They decide, well, I think it was worth it.
It was worth it. that was worth it. They give her the money. Like, yeah, that. Sam is just kind of sitting at the bar, just kind of like waiting impatiently. And Frasier's like, Sam, you're going through an awful lot of scheming and machinations to avoid dealing with Rebecca. He's like, you know, that's me, Frasier, always thinking.
That's another one of my favorite lines from the episode. He just drops it so casually. Yeah, that's me. Always thinking.
Rebecca comes in saying that she's going to change Sam's life, and he panics right away and runs to the light switch and starts flashing it and looking up the stairs, waiting. And she's like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "Oh, just you know, signal Rebecca's back. Rebecca's back. That's why I'm flashing the lights." And she grabs him and kind of pulls him aside, and she's like, she tells him that she wants to buy Cheers. And she's like, Sam, will you sell me this bar? And he's like, no, wait, what? Like, he like gut shot reaction was like, no, of course I won't. Yeah. He's like, wait, that's what you wanted to ask me? And the guys are like, she's like, yeah, you know, running this place was the only time I really felt important. People looked up to me. And Carlos, like,
I was like, who?
like legit, like not trying to be cruel like she usually is.
She's no, just like very like, confused.
She's like, who? Like you thought that? You thought somebody? So they're all kind of like, wait. So this is why you came back to buy the bar? You didn't want to marry Sam? And she's like, what? No, why would you think that? She's like, Sam, did you think I wanted to marry you? And he goes, shoot, no. He's like,
yes.
And she's like, that's why you're doing all this weird stuff. And he's like, what do you mean weird stuff? Cut to The door swings open and Leon rushes in, saying, "I can't keep living a lie, Sam." Sam's like, "Oh, Leon, no, but he can't stop him." Yep. And he tells the others that Sam is his lover. And Rebecca points out that he just resorted to this ridiculous scheme because he's a wussy little fraidy cat that wouldn't tell her how he feels. He's like, "I'm not a wussy little fraidy cat." She's like, "Well, if this true that you and Leon are lovers, give him a kiss. Why don't you do that?" And Sam is like, "Well, because we've been together for 14 years and we're no longer demonstrative."
And then he goes on to explain to Leon that the magic is gone. I should have told you sooner.
And Leon is just nodding. He's like, because Leon is already like, "I didn't sign on for this." He's like, "This is as far as I want to go." He's like, "Yeah, don't." And she's like, no. "You either kiss him on the lips or admit that you're a wussy little fraidy cat." And I love this.
And Carla just starts stirring the pot.
Carla, because you know she is so loyal to Sam. She thinks the world of Sam. But if there's one thing she can do, if there's an opportunity to cause trouble for anybody, including Sam, she will do it. Because she's like, "Sammy, don't make her look like a wussy little fraidy cat." And they just start egging him on, doing like meow, meow, doing cat things until Sam grabs Leon, gives him a kiss. And of course, the studio audience erupts because it's 1991. And your male star is kissing another man on the show. And everybody kind of freaking out. And he's like, "I'm sorry, Leon." And Leon is like, "You know, I have to punch you in the face now." And Sam's like, I hope you would. And Leon gives him a punch. Like, it splits. Like, he gets a bloody nose from that. It's a hard punch. And then Leon starts walking away. And then no hard feelings. He's like, "Are we still playing golf on Thursday?" He's like, "Oh, yeah, you bet.
Yeah, so this is obviously the bit that is at risk of feeling the most dated now. And as I was watching it, obviously the punch is an enormous overreaction to a man kissing you. You know, especially if you've made some kind of deal to pretend to be the gay partner of this man.
Right.
But I remember this period. Like, I was alive during this period, and this felt. In the homophobic society of the time, this very much felt like the reaction that all heterosexual men were supposed to have. If, you had to prove that, everybody knew you weren't gay, you had to, make that really clear. It was a very different and kind of hard to remember time. It's you can tell that by kind of the enormity of the reaction. Like, there, when Sam kisses Leon, like, as you said, the audience just erupts. Like, this is before, Ellen came out on TV, which in itself was massive. This was, just did not see anything like this. This is, in a way, it's a positive pushing of the boundaries, but then they kind of walk it back a bit with the physical, I'm going to have to punch you now. So it's kind of, I think it's a step forward, then a step back. It's an interesting one, I think.
Yeah, and I always think back to, Cheers had that episode in the very first season when Sam's baseball buddy comes out and writes this tell-all memoir where he reveals that he's gay. And everybody thinks that Cheers is going to become a gay bar if Sam doesn't do something and kick these gay guys out. And at the end, he refuses. He's like, "No, I'm not. That's not the kind of person I am." And it's like this really kind of powerful sort of message. And it's like, that was how they start off in the first season. But by the 90s, we're in the periphery of gay panic. And I think you're right, because even a few episodes before this, there was the thing where, like, Sam is pretending to be a transvestite in front of John Allen Hill. He's like, he wears women's clothes just to get out of this. And it's one of those things where I kind of give it a little bit of grace because it's not making fun of trans. It's not making fun of gays. It's making fun of the idea that Sam would be one of these things, which is not great, but it's not as bad. Like, the joke isn't about being gay. The joke is, wouldn't it be silly if Sam was, based on everything we know? So, and the fact that the reaction to this has to be being punched in the face, that has to be, but also, like, this is the worst thing that you can imagine as being like, you either admit that you're a wussy little fraidy cat or you kiss this guy. And it's like the double dare, like, which one of these is the worst option? Yeah. So it's like, all right, Okay, but
that doesn't age well. And the punch you in the mouth and I wish you would, like, that's a funny back and forth for the era. It doesn't really fly today, but it's very clearly a way to walk back the moment and make sure the audience is very clear that, you know, Sam is very much a heterosexual hero. Let's not have that unclear. It's very much of the era, I think.
Yeah. And then after this is over, Sam has a bloody nose and they give him a right to kind of like clean up the blood. And Carla's like, gosh, Sammy, you just kissed a man, but at least you're not a wussy little fraidy cat. And like, that's a win for Sam. He's like, yeah.
And he's kind of accepting the adulation of the bar with, you know, this bloody, he's holding the bloody nose. He's like giving them the thumbs up. He's like,
and our little denouement, Frasier goes, in the last 30 seconds, we have seen deceit, sexual turmoil, and sudden senseless violence. It puts me in mind of the Pickwick Papers, and holds up another Charles Dickens book. And that's when we cut away.
A great ending as well. I like that. That is, I have never read the Pickwick Papers. I'm almost certainly never will, but that is all I will ever think of it as, just this final beat of this episode.
I don't think I could tell you what David Copperfield was about. Like, I don't know that I've ever even read like a synopsis of it. So for all I know, it is about
it's dead about cops. These two coppers in a field, exactly. Their body parts switched.
Right. I read A Tale of Two Cities. I read Great Expectations, but so I'm familiar with those. But and Christmas Carol and other things. But only so much Dickens. But a funny episode. There's a lot going on. I mean, the thing about the end is it's something to still talk about, to still discuss. I'm glad like it's not a forgettable moment. Nice. Is it controversial? Yeah, there's some cringe factor, but again, could have been a lot worse. I think they kind of skate by because their intentions are good. And again, the joke is on Sam and him getting his comeuppance for, like the real truth is, why is he getting punched? It's not because he kissed guy. It's because he couldn't be honest and he couldn't deal straight with Rebecca and just confront her with the truth. That's why he has to get punched in the face. Just the delivery method was a little bit clunky there.
A little bit.
Yeah. But yeah, the subplot with Frasier reading the books and putting Stephen King in. Like I always thought like the Apache Attack Chopper was like a Rambo thing or something like that. For Norm's tab, there were so many little like scene switches and jumps ahead. So Norm had 5 beers this episode, which brings him up to 902.
Hey, he is over 900.
Who is your employee of the week?
I can't go past Frasier. He's so good this episode. I mean, we know that Kelsey Grammer got into the cast by his ability to, you know, bring comedy to normal everyday lines. But when you give him material this strong, he's just like out of this world. I love the gleam in his eye right at the end as he flips up the Pickwick Papers. It's just everything he does is so good. I mean, there are some great moments in this episode. Like, I love the Plan Z kind of planning bit. I love Rebecca on Norm's stool. But whenever I think about this episode, I always think of Frasier reinterpreting Dickens. Like, that's the episode for me.
Completely agree, 100%. Yeah, I have the same thoughts. It was Frasier. I would put Sam as my runner up just to have somebody as my runner up, but it was never a question. This was all Frasier. And I kind of forecasted this before my home run. My favorite part is when he's just looking down at the bar. He's like, "Darling, I've done some things in the past few weeks that I'm not proud of."
Yes. I can't go past. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Which was it? that entire spiel from the beginning of A Tale of Two Cities is my favorite aspect.
That probably any of the Dickens passages were a runner-up. Yes. Like the Apache Attack Chopper hovering over the guillotine. That'll probably be. And then my last runner-up, you kind of mentioned this one too, is just Norm saying, maybe it's the stool.
Yeah, that's my other one. And the only other one that was in contention was, when Sam, you're going through an awful lot of machinations to avoid dealing honestly and openly with Rebecca. That's me, always thinking.
I still love that. Like, he's complimenting him. It's like, Sam.
A good episode. A great episode. Like I said, it's probably still, there are a lot of great episodes I've remembered as I've been rewatching this along with the podcast, but I still do very much love this one. It's so outdated things and all.
Very much, very much. Yeah. Oh, Dan, thank you for coming on this this podcast to be on this episode with me. Wish we could have done this back in season 4 or 5 or whenever it was you first emailed me. But where else can people hear you, or what else would you like to plug if for the audience?
Well, I do a podcast with my partner covering the movies of Alfred Hitchcock. It's called Hitchpod. So we've done 2 seasons now. The first season, we watched every single Hitchcock movie in a random order. And then we've just finished our second season in which we kind of counted down the best 20 movies as voted by our listeners and comparing them to the best picture of the same year. And we'll start our third season shortly. So that's Hitchpod. I also do podcasts on the sport of cricket, which I'm not sure there's much of an overlap with Cheers listeners, but if you are interested, you can find all my cricket writing and stuff. I've written a few books as well. You can find all that at liebcricket.com. That's L-I-E-B cricket. And I do have a newsletter in which I write about all this stuff, and you can check out that by going to funnyisbetterthangood.com.
All right. I'll have links for that in the show notes for this one. Again, thank you very much for being on this episode. I will look forward to having you back in the future for like anytime. Season 15 or 20 or something like that. Yep. And as always, thanks to you listeners who support Cheerscast by liking and sharing on social media and leaving comments on the website fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also support the Fire and Water Podcast Network on Patreon. Cheerscast is supported by the Right On Network and Jeff and Rick Presents Unpacking the Power of Power Pack. Go to patreon.com/FWPodcast to support your favorite show on the Fire and Water Network. Thanks everyone for listening, and until next time, we're closed.
Gather around, everyone. I am going to right a horrible wrong. I am going to read to you Dickens' classic, A Tale of Two Cities, and you will see just how much fun great literature can be. Book the first. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
Wait. Which was it?
Just stay tuned, Norton. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity.
Boy, this Dickens guy really liked to keep his butt covered, didn't he?
There was a king with a large jaw and a queen with a plain face on the throne of England. And there was a bloodthirsty clown who beckoned innocent children into the sewer and swallowed them whole.
Ah, that's a neat trick.